UK Wine Show, show number 111. Ian DeGatta on Italy. On this week's show, we look deeper into the wine and health. Ian DeGatta, wine writer in Italy, gives us a lowdown on Italy, what's hot and what's not, as well as a great overview of the country.
And in the news, more Italian wine is confiscated, Bordeaux 2007 campaign draws to a close, and Diam's cork gets Tesco approval.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 111 for the 27th of June 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we talk with Ian DeGatta, award-winning wine expert on regional Italian foods and wines, and managing director of the International Wine Academy in Rome. In his spare time, he writes books including Italy's Best Wines. But before we talk to Ian, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. Sangiovese has become the latest Tuscan appellation to hit the headlines after the equivalent of 4,000 bottles of red wine were confiscated by the authorities. The equivalent of 30 hectolitres were seized from a winery after the authorities found wood chips that were apparently being used for a DOC wine. The law prohibits their use for DOCG and DOC wines, but they are allowed for IGT wines and table wine. As a result, the winery agreed to downgrade the wine to IGT and the authorities have released it. The Sangiovese confiscation follows current investigations into Brunello and Vino Nobili Montepulciano after claims that they've been blended with grapes from outside the regions. Any comments, Chris?
The pressure is mounting on the Italians to do what their DOC and DOCG quality control systems state. On the 23rd of June, the American Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, TTB, was due to ban imports of Brunello Montalcino. However, they have now dropped this. The key reason appears to be pressure from the Italian government and that laboratory testing is slow, expensive, and not always accurate. I think this is a real shame. Banning the wine, for even just a single vintage, would have put all sorts of pressure on producers and encouraged everyone to self-police. It also sends a solid threat to all dodgy Italian producers that they risk destroying their markets by playing fast and loose with the DOC and DOCG rules. Personally, while I don't have a problem with producers blending anything they like into the wines, as long as they say what they're doing, but if you claim to be 100% Sangiovese, then, to be honest, that's what it should be. It does look like the Italians have been up to all sorts of rather dodgy things, and it's not just the one region. How significant it is throughout Italy, I doubt we'll ever know. But the fact that the government has spent its time trying to convince Americans to take illegal wine, rather than trying to get to the bottom of the problem, tells me they simply don't care about their own quality standards. In this week's interview with Ian DeGatta, we talk about Brunello scandal and the underlying issues there. He also tells us how to spot dodgy Brunello di Montalcinos. What's up next, Jane?
Well, next up, Tesco has given the green light to the Diam cork as a preferred closure for its own label wines, along with screw cap and high-grade natural cork. Diam is a natural cork closure given a special CO2 treatment that removes any undesirable compounds, like trichloroanisole, or TCA as it's known, the substance responsible for cork taint. Oneo Closures, who make Diam, have been working with Tesco for 5 years, so the decision is an important milestone. They developed the Diam closure using technology that takes caffeine out of coffee. To create the closure, natural cork is granulated into a powder and then cleaned using a CO2 treatment. This removes components that could impart off flavours to a wine without leaving a residue. This clean cork flower is then rebuilt, producing a closure that gives consistency with no bottle variation. The closures also offer different levels of oxygen transfer depending on the type of wine they're to seal and whether it's destined for short or longer term ageing. Chris?
I like Diam closures. I've never had a corked wine from it, which is great. The process is not as environmentally friendly as, say, natural cork, as it does use quite a bit of power to produce the closure. But it has the advantage of taking low-grade and waste cork and turning it into a high-grade quality closure. I have heard rumours about the closure that they may not be suitable for long-term aging because the glues that are used to reconstruct the closure may break down over time. But I've not had that validated as yet, so it's just something to keep an eye on and treat it as a rumour. You can tell a Diam closure because it looks a bit like custom board and it has no grain. Also, Onio are the only people with the confidence to put the Diam name on the side of the closure. A dead giveaway. I have an interview with another cork manufacturer in a couple of weeks who says they're not allowed to put their own branding on cork. This is Tosh, as Diam's branding is on all the corks I've seen. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, finally this week, the Bordeaux 2007 En Primeur campaign drew to a close, with the vintage generally seen as overpriced and best for early drinking. Except for Chateau de Cam, the prices of the first growths were down by about a quarter compared to 2006. However, the other growths released with little or no change on 2006. And with exchange rates, this means rising prices on a vintage of a questionable quality. Opinions are mixed, with Berry Brothers and Rudd saying the majority of wines are either dilute, lack weight or over-extracted. Jancis Robinson says the stars are a long list of sweet wines, a reasonable number of dry whites, and a relatively short number of reds. While American critic Robert Parker sums up the reds by saying, there are plenty of green, thin, herbal or herbaceous wines that lack mid-palates, but the top terroirs, the finest addresses and the most committed chateau owners, by doing extensive work in the vineyard and taking advantage of the Indian summer, have produced endearingly fruity, soft, silky-textured clarets that are filled with charm and purity. Well, it just remains to be seen when they're ready to drink. Don't forget you can get these stories in full at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Thanks for the news. It'll be interesting to see how those on-premier wines are sold. If they do sell out, then the pricing was about right. If not, then the prices were too high. It's pretty simple as that. In the end, the correct price is what the market will pay. This is especially true for wines whose price is set by supply and demand and have become disconnected with the underlying quality of the wine. Always remember, a 400 quid bottle of wine is never going to be 40 times better than a 10 quid bottle of wine. I suppose the thing about expensive wine is that you're unlikely to drink too much of it. With lots of talk about sensible drinking in the press, we continue our look this week on wine and health. This week, we look at what are the limits in the UK. So, what are the limits in the UK? Recent press release by the Centre for Public Health gave a rude awakening to many wine drinkers in the UK. In a surprising set of results, it pointed out that while Liverpool and Manchester have England's highest harmful drinkers, at around 8.1% and 8.9% of the adult population respectively, it was the affluent areas that had the most hazardous drinking. While Runnymede, Harrogate, Surrey Heath, all at 26%, Guildford, Mid-Sussex, Mole Valley, Woverley and Leeds, above 25% of the adult population. But what do these limits and what is harmful and hazardous drinking? Well, let's start with sensible drinking. Sensible drinking is poorly defined and research level. It first appeared in the UK in a 1987 pamphlet called The Limit. It was described as the amount to which people should limit their drinking if they wanted to avoid damaging their health. Hazardous drinking is drinking above recognised sensible limits, but not yet experiencing harm. The risk of harm from drinking above sensible levels increases the more alcohol you drink and the more often you drink over these levels. And harmful drinking. Harmful drinking is at a level that leads to significant harm to physical and mental health, and at levels that can cause substantial harm to others. Examples include liver damage, cirrhosis, dependency on alcohol, stress, or aggression in the family. In other words, hazardous drinking is above sensible drinking, and sensible drinking means nothing, and harmful drinking is where you might feel bad, or you might cause damage to other people through your consumption. But what are the limits in the UK? Well, accordingly, men should drink no more than 21 units of alcohol per week and no more than 4 units in any one day. Between 22 and 50 units a week, a man is considered to be a hazardous drinker, and above 51 units a week, they're considered a harmful drinker. Men who regularly drink over 8 units a day are at risk of such alcohol-related harm as abusing their wives or cirrhosis of the liver. Women should drink no more than 14 units per week, and no more than 3 units in any one day. between 15 and 35 units a week is considered a hazardous drinker, and above 36 were considered a harmful drinker. Women who regularly drink over 6 units a day are at the highest risk of such alcohol-related harm as coming home drunk and beating up their husbands. That ends this week's Spotlight. Next week, we continue our look at wine and health by looking at what other countries say about the limits. We also announce this week's poll, which is, how many units in a 250ml glass of wine? Is it 1, 2, 3, or 4? Please go to our website, 3050.co.uk, click on the podcast button, and you can enter your results on the right-hand side. Next up, we are talking with Ian DeGarter, wine writer and show judge. Ian is a lovely, friendly person, and we talk to him about Italian wines. And while generalising about such a complicated and complex country as Italy, we try and get an overview. Let's have a listen to what Ian has to say. Hi, I'm here with Ian DeGarter. You're a wine writer and director of International Wine Academy in Italy. How are you, Ian?
Thank you, I'm fine. It's great to be here.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about Italy. It's quite nice to talk to an Italian with a fantastic Canadian accent.
Absolutely. My mother sent me to Toronto, Canada when I was 12 years old. She wanted me to learn English, and she had her way. I couldn't really argue at that age.
So what we're going to do is just get an overview of Italy, because I find Italy quite complicated. When I was studying wine, we got France thrown down our throat, and I would have rather had a bit more waiting on Italy and other countries. But it's quite hard to get your head around if you've just been shown France all the time.
Right.
What's the thing about Italy, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, it's confusing for Italians as well. You got to consider Italy, for one thing, is a country that has the most, the largest number of grape varieties from which to make wine. We have over 2,500 grape varieties, of which only about 1,000 have been genetically identified. And of these 1,000, we make wine from about 600. So we're throwing at the general public 600 different grape varieties from which we make wine, plus all the blends, and you just know how creative Italians can be. Keep in mind that 99% of all French wine is made from 15 grape varieties.
Yeah.
And 99% of all California wine is made from 7 grape varieties. So Italy's throwing 600 at you. And so that tells you why it's confusing. It's very confusing. Plus, Italy is very attached to its roots and its tradition and its history, and therefore it has recognized over the years that some areas give you maybe better wines with a single grape variety. So you just don't have Sangiovese, and you just don't have Merlot like you do everywhere else, but you also have names of wines that are made with Sangiovese, but reflect a special area in which Sangiovese does extremely well. For example, Brunello is 100% Sangiovese, which is a typical Italian grape variety. In Italy, you will have Brunello and you will have Sangiovese. And all that means is that Sangiovese-labeled wine is made with Sangiovese that comes from a less famous, less historically important area than the one that is labeled Brunello, because that Brunello is a wine made with Sangiovese that has grown there. And over the centuries, people have seen that the Sangiovese grown in the Brunello area, which is basically around the city of Montalcino, gives you a much higher quality product. And therefore, the growers who have the luck of having good vines there, they don't want to call their wine Sangiovese. They want to call it Brunello. And therefore, it's confusing for people, because it's not just like in Australia or California where you have wines labeled by variety alone. In Italy, you have the varietals, but you also have many wines named with a place, because that place has long been associated with high quality. A good example is Barolo. Barolo is made with the Nebbiolo grape, and you have simple, everyday Nebbiolo-labeled bottles.
Sure.
But you also have Barolo, and that's the ones that everybody wants.
Going back to Brunello, isn't it a specific clone?
Yeah, that's a good question. In reality, that's actually, now we know that not to be true anymore. It is true, and yet it isn't. All the books on wine today, especially the older ones, will tell you that there were basically two types of Sangiovese. Sangiovese and then Sangiovese Grosso, also known as Brunello, which is the bigger buried grape cluster and the one that supposedly gives you Brunello. In reality, we now know that Sangiovese is a family or a population of different grape varieties. There are hundreds of different clones, and even in Montalcino, you have many, many different sub-varieties of Sangiovese. So although historically Montalcino has been associated with the Sangiovese Grosso variety, just like Montepulciano has been associated with the Prugnolo Gentile variety, in reality we know that in Montalcino and Montepulciano, all the growers are using 5, 6, 8 different clones and sub-varieties. So that's not true anymore.
Do you want to give us a big overview? Because Italy's a long, fairly skinny country that grows grapes all the way down. What do you expect for the wines as you move, say, from north to south? Because there seems to be quite clear bands of different grape varieties.
Absolutely. Well, the key thing to Italy, and this is what I always say when I'm guiding my wine tastings or at the wine school, the best way to learn Italy and to know about Italian wines is by understanding the grapes. Because the grape varieties are intrinsically located to each region. For example, you have Canonau in Sardinia and nowhere else. You have Aglianico in basically Campania and Basilicata and nowhere else. Nebbiolo itself, you really only have in Piedmont, even though you do also have it in Val d'Aosta and Lombardy. In reality, you find that you find it certainly nowhere else in Italy, and even in those other two regions, it's not all that present. So by learning the major grape varieties of every single region, you already have a much better understanding of Italian wine than you would otherwise. Moving down from north to south, clearly it's the same like everywhere else. North to south in Italy, you're gaining a lot in heat and light, and therefore as you go down, the wines become always higher in alcohol and higher in extract and color. So the southern Italian wines can touch easily 15 degrees of alcohol and are usually richer and softer.
So if you start off at the top, you've got Nebbiolo is the key red up there.
Absolutely.
And that's high acidity, high tannins.
Absolutely. Nebbiolo is one of the world's greatest grape varieties. I think most experts will tell you that if they really had to do an impartial list of the 5 greatest grape varieties in the world, Nebbiolo would probably be in there along with Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir. It's a high acid grape variety. It's a late ripener. But like Pinot Noir, it gives you remarkable finesse and remarkable fruitiness. It's also the best translator of soil along with Pinot Noir and Riesling in the world. No Nebbiolo will ever taste alike depending on the soil it's grown in. In other words, a Nebbiolo grown in a sandy soil is completely different than one grown in a clay soil and so on and so forth. It ages forever because of that high acidity.
Yep.
If you were lucky enough to find a well-kept 1947 Barolo, it would still be a thing of beauty today, as would a 1961 or a 1967 or a 1971. They're just great vintages and great, great wines. They age forever.
You come down. See, I always think of Italy sort of in maybe 3 sections. I've got the north, I've got the center,
sure.
I've got the south. Center is
right.
Like for red, it's Sangiovese.
Right, perfect.
And in the south, you're probably getting into Nera d'Avola or something like that. Is that a fair comment? Or?
Absolutely. No, really. If you want to break it down by red grape varieties, the north is really dedicated to Nebbiolo. Dolcetto, which is an everyday table. Absolutely, yeah. And the everyday table wine that people love. Actually, this is not a sexist comment because I like them too. Women love Dolcetto, and that's something that all us guys should know and remember. Barbera, another very important red grape that's an everyday table wine, although they've turned to some making some expensive Barberas now by small barrel fermenting and aging. Another very important grape in the north might be something like Corvina. In reality, Corvina...
It's white, isn't it?
No, it's actually a red. There is a white Corvina, but it's rare. The Corvina is the one that is used for Valpolicella and Amarone. But by itself, it's not a great, great grape. And therefore, Valpolicella and Amarone are, in fact, blends of Corvina, Corvinone, Rondinella, and a few other grape varieties. And those are the basis of the great wine called Amarone and things like that. In the center, Sangiovese for sure. Sangiovese, Italy's most planted grape variety, at least in the red section, found everywhere from central Italy down south, and it really plays the lion's share. There's a very interesting grape in Umbria called Sagrantino, giving you very tannic wines that is rapidly on the rise, and people might want to take a look at a few Sagrantinos di Montefalco for big, burly red wines. In the south, yeah, your main two grapes are Nero d'Avola because it's all over Sicily, and even more important, probably Aglianico. Aglianico is found in Campania, where that's where Naples and the island of Capri are, and Basilicata. Basilicata being that little region in between Italy's heel and toe, Italy being a boot-shaped country.
Yep.
And Aglianico is a great wine. Aglianico is probably the next hot red grape variety Italy has. You haven't read about Aglianico much in the important wine magazines, and that's a mistake. It will change, and I bet you will see in the next few years Aglianico-only articles. It's a red grape that has the power and finesse of Nebbiolo, Can age almost as well and has some of the smoky, ripe cherry, plum qualities of Syrah. So a grape that's got everything going for it.
Is that the one that's going on the Vulture Mountain?
Or yeah, good for you. Great. Yeah, the Vulture. It's written Vulture in Italian. We pronounce it Vulture, but it's written like a vulture. The call of the Vulture, it's an extinct volcano. What you need to know about Aglianico is that it does really well on volcanic soil. In fact, another very good Aglianico is the one from Taurasi in the Campania region, and Taurasi is another extinct volcanic area. The Vulture, or the Vulture, is so called because it's an extinct volcano that has seven peaks. So if you look at it from afar, it actually does look like it's the bird of prey with its wings outstretched. Now, I'll tell you, I've been there something like 26 times in the last 3 years for a book I'm writing, and it only looks like the Vulture they're talking about after you've had a lot of that red wine in question. Because otherwise it looks nothing like the lousy bird of prey, no. Not at all.
Okay, Nero d'Avola came over in the UK. When I first got in the trade about 5-7 years ago, it was the sort of quite a hot, interesting wine. Because it's quite soft and round, almost like a Merlot for me.
Absolutely. It's very hot in Italy, too. It does remind you of Merlot, often because they blend it with Merlot, quite frankly. In reality, Nero d'Avola, we've learned recently, is a distant relative of Syrah and of Taraldego, a northern Italian grape. And in fact, good Nero d'Avolas ought to have a little spiciness. Along with the herbaceousness, they ought to have a little bit of spiciness reminiscent of a Syrah. And it's a very, very up-and-coming grape, very hot grape, because it does have soft tannins. It does have a bit of a jammy nature to it, and it's just hard not to like. It also gives you a spectrum of different wines. You can have a light red from Nero d'Avola, and you can have a very rich keeper of a wine, so it's appealing to everybody.
The South isn't really known for its whites. You normally land up heading quite far north.
Right.
Is there anything... any white wines from the south or middle of Italy to keep an eye out for?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's actually true, and yet it's unfair because it's true. I think if I were telling somebody who's just learning about wine, I would say exactly that. I would say, you know what, from the south, go with the reds, and Italy's... But in reality, the southern Italian whites are on a roll. They're getting better and better. For no other reason, because the Italian producers themselves are now paying more attention to them. So Sicily, for example, is a very good place for Italian white wines. They have a very interesting grape called Carricante, or Caricante, with an English accent. Caricante grows on the Etna mountain, and it's a distant relative of Riesling, and as it ages, it does develop some hydrocarbon-type aromas. It's a very mineral wine. And it's a lovely, elegant wine. And then you have everyday quaffing wines in Sicily called Grillo, for example, and then Zolia. They're cheap, they're inexpensive, they're fruity, they're fresh, and they're not oxidized like they used to be. Also very important, I think, in Sardinia is Vermentino. Vermentino is basically the roll or Malvoisie, Petit Grand of Spain and southern France. It's lovely on Sardinia, has a nice salty edge, it reminds you a little bit of rosemary and thyme. And it just goes down like water, and if you're lying by the beach on a hot summer day, you couldn't ask for anything better. Last but not least, and I do want to stress this, is you've got some very interesting grapes coming out of Lazio, where Rome is located, and Umbria. Grechetto, or Little Greco, which has nothing to do with the Greco of Campania, which gives you the Greco di Tufo wine, is a grape that they're learning more and more about and seems to have real, real potential. And it's found both in Umbria and in Lazio. It's usually associated with Orvieto, but now we know that there's different subvarieties of Grechetto. And the one used for Orvieto is often not the most interesting one. It gives a neutral, insipid wine. Then there are some very good Grechettos that are actually much more fuller-bodied and not unlike a Riesling or a Chardonnay, depending on what they do to it.
But the whites are really known up north. You know, you've got your Frillies and your Collios, all that sort of stuff. One thing about, well, do you want to touch on that first? And then I want to make a comment about it, because I really don't get expensive Italian wine. I just don't understand
it. Right. Well, no, I think you're right. I think you know, if you really had to say to somebody, the best place for Italian white wines are certainly in the north, Friuli, Venezia Giulia, and Alto Adige. Probably today, Alto Adige makes Italy's best whites. The only thing you need to know about Alto Adige is that it used to be part of Germany, part of Austria, up until the end of World War I. Then at the end of World War I, Italy was on the right side of the war then, because they basically won, and they got part of Austria, which is what we call today Alto Adige or South Tyrol. And therefore, because it used to be part of Austria, it's where you find a lot of German-sounding names, but also where you find a lot of Germanic grape varieties. So that is the place in Italy for Riesling, for Kerner, for Gewürztraminer, and for Silvaner. Pinot Grigio, of course, and Alto Adige does those all very well. I would say, and this might be something that the listeners here may not be as aware of, Italy makes actually outstanding Silvaner and Kerner. I know that may sound like an oxymoron, but in reality, that's something that we do very, very well, and they're always dry. We don't make off-dry wines, and they're remarkably fruity and fresh and floral and slightly spicy, at least Kerner. And they're lovely, lovely wines. Better, I would say, than most of the other European varieties. We make lovely Gewürztraminer. Italy probably makes the best dry Gewürztraminers in the world. Alsatian Gewürztraminers are fantastic and they're hard to beat, but they often have a high residual sugar, which is something that you will never see in Italy. So if you want a dry Gewürz, a dry Kerner, a dry Silvaner, Italy's the place to be. You have some great Silvaners, dry Silvaners from Alsace, but they're almost as good in Italy. About the only thing that in Italy we need to work on in Alto Adige is Riesling. We make decent Rieslings, but they're not on the same level as, I'll say, Alsace's or Germany's. They are dry, though, so if you're looking for a dry Riesling, Italy is a good bet. Friuli, of course, great place. They make these very big, rich blends. You all know them, where they blend Chardonnay into native grape varieties, and they're very interesting wines. They're often not even oaked, so they're fresh, they're fruity, they're clean, yet are full-bodied, and so they go very well, not just with fish, but also with white meat dishes. And plus, you've got Pinot Grigio and Pinot Bianco and Chardonnay. I would say that Italy, as a general rule, does not excel with Chardonnay, but we do very well with Sauvignon, and that's something to keep in mind.
Sauvignon Blanc?
Yeah, we do very well with Sauvignon.
Oh, I haven't tried that.
It falls in between the grassy style of Sancerre in France and the gooseberry tropical fruit style of New Zealand. Italian Sauvignon Blancs will not be tropical fruity infused like the New Zealanders, but they won't be grassy as the French either. So it falls right down the middle, and it's usually a very good buy. Most people like them quite a bit. It's the Chardonnays you got to be careful about in Italy, because most of our Chardonnays are over-oaked.
What about price of Italian whites? Because I find them quite eye-watering, and often they don't taste of much.
Yeah.
Is that a function of the fact that whites are rare? Or good quality whites are rare in Italy because it's more of a red country, and therefore it's like New Zealand Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris. It's expensive in New Zealand because it's the locals like it because they don't get it normally. Or is it a function of the fact that I just don't get it because it doesn't? I'm not drinking it with the right food or something.
No, that's true. I mean, the problem with Italian wine is it's becoming expensive. It's a shame because in some respects, it runs the risk of pricing itself out of the market with these Chilean, Australian wines that cost so little and are faultless. Friuli wines especially tend to be expensive. So do Alto Adige. They're not hideously expensive, but they do cost a little bit more than the other ones. A lot of it has to do with the work hours that go into it. Alto Adige, they're all mountain vineyards. They're often terraced. It takes a lot of work. You can't mechanize anything. It's not like in Australia where they've got the machines running through these vineyards. In Italy, unfortunately, we still use, you know, we have to use people, and that will bring up costs. So Italy's goal has to be to make very high-quality fine wines to justify the price tag that they're asking, because otherwise people will, you know, not, you can't blame them. They'll go after a very good Australian white or New Zealand white, and you know, that's perfectly understandable.
It's a cost factor as opposed to maybe a food thing.
It really is. It's mainly a cost factor and there's a food thing. Yeah, Italy would be very happy to make low-priced white wines, just like they do the reds. Italy still is today one of the best sources for low-priced wines.
Pinot Gris.
Pinot Gris, for sure. And actually, you know,
Pinot Grigio,
Pinot Grigio, yeah, it's the same grape. No, no, actually, that's good. It reminds us to tell people out there that Pinot Gris and Pinot Grigio are, in fact, the same thing. I often get that question when I'm teaching these classes in Rome. But I think the one thing I'd like to point out with Pinot Grigio is that it's one of the world's best-selling wines. In the United States, it's the best-selling import. It outsells Australian Shiraz 2-1, and Shiraz is the second best-selling foreign varietal in the States. The problem with Pinot Grigio sold abroad is, and therefore I would caution your listeners and wine lovers, is that a lot of Italian Pinot Grigio sold isn't really Pinot Grigio to begin with. There's a lot of Trebbiano dumped in there, and that's because there is such a fad over Italian Pinot Grigio. It's so popular nowadays that Italy really can't keep up with demand. And, you know, unfortunately, it's rumored that, you know, a lot of Pinot Grigio that's being bottled isn't even all Pinot Grigio, which is a shame, because when you get a good Pinot Grigio, it's a thing of beauty. There is a reason why it's so popular, and that is because it's very food flexible. It goes remarkably well with a variety of foods. And because it falls right in between the flavor and aroma spectrums of Chardonnay and Sauvignon. In other words, what I mean by that is Pinot Grigio is slightly herbal, like Sauvignon, but never as grassy as Sauvignon can be sometimes. And it's very fruity, but never as fruity as some Chardonnays, which tend to be fruit cocktails. And you realize that if you're having, you know, pan-fried turbot or shrimp, the last thing you want to drink is a Chardonnay that's 15 degrees alcohol and smells of butterscotch, caramel, papaya, and mango. It just won't work for you. It might work with their cuisine in California, where I live, and I dearly love the place. It's beautiful. But, you know, it's normal for them there to have a slab of tuna or halibut with a mango, lemon, pepper, butter chutney. But we don't do that in Italy, so we don't need to have a Chardonnay that's 15 degrees in alcohol and redolent of mango and papaya. It won't work for our cuisine.
We'll just wrap up in a minute, but we're recording this in April, and just recently there was a bit of a scandal with some Italian wines getting confiscated.
Yeah.
What was the story behind that?
Well, I was in Montalcino, and unfortunately what happened was that there had been long rumors flying around that Brunello di Montalcino was not all Sangiovese, Sangiovese being the grape variety, the lone grape variety that is allowed in Brunello. And unfortunately, people were raising eyebrows over a number of years because of the color of some Brunellos. And you need to realize that Sangiovese is a grape variety that does not have the pigments, what we call in technical terms anthocyans, to give you a very dark wine. Basically, to have a black-hued Brunello is impossible, and in reality, it's impossible to have even a purple or violet-hued Brunello, even when they're young, because Sangiovese does not give you that color. Now, the problem is that recently we saw a lot of black Brunellos coming out, and people were questioning this. And it was rumored that as much as 20 or 30% of Brunello may be laced with Syrah or Merlot or Cabernet. Why would that be? Well, Sangiovese is a late ripening grape variety. And in Tuscany, even though people think of Italy as a warm country, in reality, in Tuscany, in the late fall and certainly in January, December, it often rains, hails, snows, and Sangiovese has trouble ripening. So in an effort to improve the wine in the bad years, it can happen that a producer might think, well, I'll just slip a little Merlot or Syrah in. You know, you can't prove this is happening, and nobody would imply officially that they're doing it. But the questions were raised because some Brunellos were way too black. And yes, there are new clones. Yes, there are clones that have been specifically developed over the years to give you much darker hued wines. That's very true. They do exist. However, they can only give you a darker ruby or deeper ruby wine. They cannot, by most people's accounts and experience, give you a black wine. And yet, black wines were being made. And what happened was that some producers who were making typical Brunello in the old style, light hued and so on and so forth, got angry. They complained and enough noise was made. They sent bottles to the investigative forces who looked into this. And the investigative forces went into the vineyards. They did find Merlot vines and Cabernet vines and Syrah vines in the middle of Sangiovese plots. Now, I do want to stress that just because you have Merlot vines in your Sangiovese vineyard, that does not automatically mean that you're then using that Merlot and Cabernet or Syrah in your Brunello, which is what the domains or the houses that are being investigated are saying, and you can't blame them. The question is, though, what's going into the bottle? There are ways you can analyze that, and you can do things like nuclear magnetic resonance with mass spectroscopy, or you can do anthocyan profiles to figure out if there's anything in that wine. I just want to say that it's a real shame if you have to reduce wine to nuclear magnetic resonance. There's a lot more poetry and hedonism to wine, and we don't want to really get carried away with all that. Basically, Sangiovese ought to be the only grape allowed in Brunello. Yes, in the bad years, if you put in Merlot and Syrah, it's going to be a much better tasting wine. But you then run the risk of making the wine taste like any other Merlot or Syrah out there. So you have to understand, you know, both sides of the coin here. I do totally understand those people who say, if we don't put a little Merlot in, we're going to make a bad wine 1 year out of two or 1 year out of three. But the other people say, listen, if we put in too much Merlot or Syrah, the wine's going to taste like anything else, and we lose our identity. So it's a very difficult situation, and one that Italy has to analyze carefully.
And the last question is on screw caps. We're recording this at the IWC tasting, and I did some tastings with you. You were my panel judge. And one of the things that came up was that when we were doing an Italian flight, we knew the wine was IGT simply because screw caps don't go onto DOC or DOCG wines. What's the beef with screw caps in Italy? Because, let's face it, the Italians invented screw caps from what I understand.
Well, you know, the thing is, wine in Italy has always had lots of lore and mystique, like in France and everywhere else. And the fact is, people associate wine with the cork. And there's so much mystique and so much hedonism to opening a bottle of wine with a corkscrew. You never see James Bond unscrewing a screw cap. And, and it's the same thing in Italy. So people are leery in Italy, maybe because it's such a tradition-laced country, to move to screw caps. Also, keep in mind that the reality of Italy's wine world is that the majority of our wine estates are small. They are family-run. In order to switch to screw caps, you have to change your bottling line, and that's a very expensive endeavor, so many people don't really want to invest that sort of money. But I would say that even more important, it is the mystique of the cork. People in Italy feel that the better wines are the ones with the cork, and yet we're not at screw caps like they would be in Australia and New Zealand. It will happen over time, because it's just the way of the world, and that's probably the future. But Italy certainly is one of the countries that has fewer screw cap bottles than anybody else. And the law, in fact, as you were very correctly pointing out, still reflects that. In order to get a DOCG wine, it has to have a cork.
I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your time.
Hey, that was fun. Thanks.
Cheers, mate.
Ciao.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Ian. I found him very friendly and warm person. Do keep an eye out for his book. Next week, we're going to be talking with Carlos De Jesus from Amarim on corks. So stay tuned for that. Before we finish up, let's have this week's joke. Well, to be honest, it's more of a quote than a joke, and with a health warning attached. Apparently, this quote can be attributed to Jack Handy, whoever he is. Sometimes when I reflect back on the wine I drink, I feel shame. Then I look into the glass and think about the workers in the vineyard and all their hopes and dreams. If I don't drink this wine, they might be out of work and their dreams will be shattered. Then I say to myself, it's better that I drink the wine and let someone's dreams come true than be selfish and worry about my liver. So, until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.